Is it just audio recording, or do you shoot
sound? No, it's video.
Whatever you guys have on the screen in terms of a presentation or going on the internet, whatever, it'll record that too. And okay. Your voice overlaps, whatever you say.
So,
I'll have to plug this one though. Gray one.
Oh, sure. Probably good.
No,
soll ich uns noch kurz Wasser holen?
Oh ja. Is the microphone actually working? Yes. Perfect. Yours is working too? Do I have to tell more drinking stories for you to level it out?
Just do some humpa.
Nah. You don't get me to sing.
Einfach gleich mit,
klar.
Weil sonst...
Klar. Dann gebe ich dir irgendwie ein Zeichen. Klar. Ich irgendwie sowas. Kann ich lieber stellen. Zwischendurch irgendwie so was wie please send me an unprivileged process.
Seite rum. Ja. Sonst
Eben in der Mitte stehe ich vor dem Salz. Und wenn man es beide hier aufs Backpacke dann trinkt, ist es irgendwie auch eurem.
Again?
I think you might have the one that I need here.
Okay. Am I supposed to turn this off before? Do you see whether this is working already?
Pardon me?
Do you see whether this is working already?
Yeah. And it is, yeah.
Okay, so it's fine. Perfect.
Oh, techno Henning.
Whenever you're ready, just give a thumbs up.
Okay. Maybe a minute or two.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Keine andere Taste benötigt die ganze Zeit. Keine andere Taste benötigt die ganze Zeit. Okay, I think we're ready. Okay, welcome. My name is Henning. This is my co-talker Sven. We are going to talk about secure programming, which unfortunately is a pretty boring topic. I hope we found a way to make this a little bit more interesting for you guys. We tried hard. Software security is deeply related to software quality, and instead of making claims ourselves about the state of software quality, we looked what other people had to say on the topic. So, first quote, folks, let's be honest, Sturgeon was an optimist, way more than 90% of code is crap. I couldn't agree more. There are two ways of constructing a software design. One way is to make it so simple that there are obviously no deficiencies, and the other way is to make it so complicated that there are no obvious deficiencies. Second part of the quote is what I would say is the state of the software industry right now. Or accepting the fallout. This one's actually my favorite. One of my most productive days was throwing away 1,000 lines of code. Ken Thompson. This matches the OpenBSD philosophy very well. More code is not better. So, very important, if you are a programmer yourself, you're mostly talking about userland programming here. If you're a programmer yourself and start working on something new, please sit down and design first, which means that you actually delay coding. Take time for the design and think about it. Think about it for weeks if needed. Don't just sit down and start hacking. This never, ever works out the way you want it to be. Right now, we see software that's very often broken and insecure in the design already. The implementation might be good, might be bad, but if the design's wrong, that doesn't help. As I said, take your time for the design, and yes, this delays coding. In the end, you'll save time. If you design properly, you will hopefully not introduce beautiful code like this one that we found in commercial software. Using a two-dimensional character array to store an IP address is a very good idea. And I don't even want to think how this scales to IPv shit. Next one. This is an example of designing first. This is from our network mini hackathon in Japan in 2008, which is the it's one step of the redesign of the PF state table, which is actually pretty complicated. And this whiteboard took us 3 hours, and this was well invested time. Security by obscurity does not work. Puffy cannot hide behind this little tree. Just look at the exploits published. It's not like open source software has more exploits published than closed source, so hiding the source code doesn't help. And if you're obfuscating your code, assuming it's open source, of course, well, actually, it doesn't really make a difference. Obfuscating your code, the obfuscation mostly works against the people working on your code, not for the people attacking your code. Most of the time, attackers are not even reading your code, right? So don't do it, doesn't help. Most security problems are simple bugs, which in turn means that to get secure software, you're really looking at improving the quality of your software. There's no security plugin, like using a broken piece of shit software and adding some magic cool aid is not going to work. That might be Band-Aid, but it's not going to solve your problems. And especially when talking to your bosses in a commercial software development environment, there is indeed no direct return of investment for investing time and thus money in security. But since security is more or less a byproduct of correct design and especially software quality, in the long term, you'll save money because your test cycles get shorter, you'll have less bugs, and we all know how long it takes to hunt bugs, right? How often have you spent 2 days looking for some little bug and the fix is one line, right? So this is not very efficient. And in turn, investing in software quality makes you more efficient. Coding standards help a lot. The OpenBSD style, there's a man page for it, just called style, is a good start. It defines some rules how code should look like. Why is this important? If all code looks like, it's really much, much, much easier to quickly grasp what's going on, and it's easier to find or to see obvious bugs. The APIs you're using, you better understand them. Very often when coding, we have the man pages for the APIs open that we are using, even if we know them. So please don't blindly use something at the point where it compiles, assume it's right. Understand and spend time understanding the APIs you're using. The probably most important rule for secure software and high-quality software is keep it simple. Simple and stupid, actually. What to say about it? It's kind of obvious, right? The more complex it gets, the easier it is to introduce bugs, right? So keep it as simple as you can, but not simpler. And in the end, most code is simple and boring, sorry, but it should be. It should be. It should be easy to follow and easy to grasp. And whenever there is some extremely clever piece of code, you can assume it's wrong. It will be. Yeah. Bugs. If you found a bug, look for the same bug in other places or the same class of bugs. Chances are very high that the same mistake has been made more than once. So don't just fix it in this one place where you found it. Check your entire tree, product, whatever. Check your entire code for it. It helps a lot if your code is easily graphable. Bugs tend to return, so it's a very good idea to use some kind of bug tracking database or the like to keep track of your bugs. As said, they tend to return, and being able to look up bugs and issues from the past can help a lot when fighting current bugs. Return codes. So most functions have a return code. Why? Well, they can indicate failure. So every time you use something that is not void, you gotta check the return code. Most of the time, you just bail out if it fails. Like if a malloc fails, there's usually not much you can do, right? So you just terminate. Don't just go on, well, you'll probably terminate too because your program will just, that's just stack fault. But if you get a little bit unlucky, you just have some buffer overflow, writing over memory that belongs to something else. So this can lead to really bad security issues. So the R function is really your friend there. Check the return codes of pretty much everything that has one. There's one exception. There's no point in checking the printf return value. The example we have here is unfortunately pretty common. Malloc almost never fails. So many people do not check the malloc return value. Malloc can return null, right? So allocating something and then blindly writing into it will hopefully, depending on the platform you're on OpenBSD, it will segfault. Yeah?
What about free?
What are you going to do if free fails? I'm not entirely sure right now. I think on OpenBSD it can't fail, but I'm not sure whether this is the rule. Pardon?
It can never fail. You do something stupid and give random pointer. But if you give a valid pointer, it won't.
See? It can fail. Well.
But if you have invalid pointers, then
What are you going to do if free fails? Honestly, you can't do much. Probably. Well, it probably crashes soon thereafter, but free is an interesting case.
Free, there's no way for it to fail and be detected.
There's no way for it to fail and being able to recover.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I agree with.
Okay. Well, it's a turn void, so.
It is actually, okay. So,
look to the API.
Exactly. Back to the talk. APIs, I briefly talked about APIs already. If you design your non-trivial piece of software properly, you'll not only use a lot of system-provided APIs or library-provided APIs, you're also going to have a lot of internal APIs. And the same rule applies. Take time to design those properly. Experience shows that if an API can be abused or misused, it will be. Best example are the string handling functions, strcopy and strcat. We'll come back to that later. So again, here, design your APIs right. Even if you think they are your private thingy and you can adjust them anytime, spend some time thinking about them. If they are not clearly... it's not clear how to use this, or if it's easy to abuse this API, this will happen sooner or later. Yeah, you're not writing your software for a week, right? It's going to be around much longer. So and over time, it will be misused if it's easy to be misused. Understanding semantics. You don't go on a bike and drive backwards, right? So same applies for your programming. A very good example that's important to understand semantics are file descriptors. One example that many people forget is the inheritance of file descriptors over fork. Everything you have open in your main process is also opened in your fork process, right? So chances are you want to close all the file descriptors in the fork or the original process, depending on your program logic. And don't forget the standard in, standard out, and standard error file descriptors. These are often overlooked, and chances are your daemon doesn't need them. Another example with file descriptors are the access rights. They are only changed on open, so you can open a file, change the permissions behind your back, and you will still be able to write to it if you had the right permissions on the time of opening the file descriptor, right? So that has to be kept in mind and shows that it's important to understand the semantics of the things you're using. In many places, we have hidden state somewhere, the most prominent example being Arno. This is pretty interesting, especially with signal handlers, or in general with asynchronous program flows. If you do something in a signal handler that could potentially trash Arno, you might have a problem, because your signal might interrupt you between something in your main program flow returning an error, like return -1. Then your signal comes in, your signal handler does something, crashes Arno, and then you're back in your main program and try to act on the Arno you got, but unfortunately your signal handler trashed them. So if you're doing anything in a signal handler or in general in asynchronous program flow setups that could trash Arno, you have to save and restore it. You shouldn't do anything in a signal handler that could trash Arno in the first place, but that's a different topic. Standard I/O buffers have a lot of hidden state. So printf in a signal handler is a no-go. And again, signal handlers, it's really easy to introduce races. So keep that in mind. You could be interrupted any time. Might be even in the middle of a printf if you're unlucky. Signal handlers. Signal handlers are complex enough for an entire separate presentation. And in fact, I gave one years ago. The rule of thumb that really gets you to a point where they are safe is to only ever set flags in a signal handler, and in your main program, check those flags and act on them later. The flag variables must be declared as volatile sig atomic T. Nothing else is valid. On OpenBSD, I think on all platforms we run on sig atomic T is just an int, but no assumptions. Use this data type. That's what it's for. And almost everything is forbidden in signal handlers. On OpenBSD, the signal man page has a list of functions that are legal in signal handlers, and it has a separate list of functions that are legal in signal handlers on OpenBSD. So even if you're not programming on OpenBSD, this man page is worth looking at. This is a correct signal handler. We define our flags, initialize them. Don't forget to initialize. The signal handler itself is just setting those flags. Nothing else. And somewhere, this is not shown here in the main, most programs have something like a main event loop, right? And somewhere in there, you just check those flags and act on them. And the last few lines here register our signal handler for certain signals. Abstraction layers. This kind of is the same topic as APIs. Many of the security issues we found over the years come from abstraction layer violation. So something far up that's using something makes assumptions how the subsystem works internally and tries to be clever or faster or something like this by directly modifying internals. This might work. Then a few years later, the subsystem is replaced, and suddenly everything doesn't work anymore. So abstraction layers are important, and do not violate them. Again, you have the issue of hidden variables. Like, it's never a good idea to write to Arno directly, right? Well, actually, there are cases, but be careful. There are concurrency issues. Keep them in mind, especially, again, if you have asynchronous program flow, like reacting to signals again. One of the most or more common, more and more common problems we see these days are integer overflows. What if you're just doing the I++ style in a loop, at one point, a 32-bit integer will not be enough. What happens? Keep that in mind. On a signed integer, the behavior is not even defined. On an unsigned one, it's defined to just wrap around, but keep the consequences in mind. So if you have an integer variable that, well, say size, and you want to allocate memory using this size parameter, and, well, you need 20 bytes more, so you do plus 20. What if it wraps around? Suddenly you might allocate 2 bytes instead of 2 gigabytes plus, it was actually 4 gigabytes plus. So very important. And a major source of security issues are in the flow control in your program when something failed. The error paths are usually not tested, right? Because most things don't fail. But someone, when they actually fail, you enter the paths, the code paths that you did not test. So spend a lot of time making sure that your error handling code is right. It's hard to test, but make sure it's right. When you're programming in a team, like most of you won't program alone, right? So if you're programming in a team, one thing that is extremely important is communication. And this includes going for beer. This is what I think Linux suffers most, but it's another topic. Talking to your colleagues is very important, and socializing with them really, really, really helps. The OpenBSD project shows this very well, right? User input. Back to beer. All user input must be checked. All. You have to use positive checks and not negative ones. Like if you get some string as input, checking that there's no semicolon in there is pointless. You have a list of allowed characters, not a list of forbidden characters. The list of forbidden ones will not work. It'll fail sooner or later. And everything that's not statically in your program must be assumed to be user input and must be checked properly. This is the most classic security bugs come from unchecked user input. The knee syndrome, the not invented here syndrome. There is no point in reinventing the wheel again and again and again and again. It's much better to use proven code. They might have had the bugs before and fixed them. They're shit code that you don't want to use, right? But usually, look for prior art, and if it's under acceptable license and good style and everything, please just use that instead of reinventing them. One of my favorite examples is the Nintendo Wii. There was a very nice presentation about it at the Chaos Computer Congress in 2008, I think, where they managed to run their own code on the Wii. Talk is called We Fail. It's a very good talk. And one of the bugs that they had to use to be able to take over the Wii was SHA-1 related. The binaries are signed, and only signed binaries are executed, right? And instead of using the proven SHA-1 code that everybody's using, they wrote their own. And to check the signatures, they use strncomp. Doesn't look all that bad, does it? Well, it is. What if I feed it a signature that starts with null bytes? It'll be accepted. So this is, again, a case of knowing your APIs. The signatures, well, they are strings, but you have to keep in mind that a null, the null character ends the string, right? The other DORs that they had to use is another classic. They have an encryption chip that safely stores the keys. But since it was so slow, they put a copy of the keys in the VGA memory, which is easy to access. Optimizations. Usually, optimizing your code is pointless. What you should do is optimizing your design. Most code optimizations in practice don't make a fucking difference. Even if they do in your micro benchmark, they usually don't make a difference in practice. On the other hand, optimized code is often very, very hard to follow, which means that over time, you'll just introduce new bugs. Also, optimizations are often counterproductive. Something that you optimized might be faster on your own machine, but running on another class of machines, this might actually be 10 times slower. And again, you're not writing your software to run for a week. It's going to be around much longer. So what if it's running a different operating system? The optimization on your OS might be counterproductive on another operating system, and the environment, operating system, libraries, hardware change over time. So what was faster yesterday might not be faster today. We see this a lot with stuff optimized for the Macs still around. If you have to optimize, be very careful. Again, don't do micro-optimizations and micro-benchmarks. That looks good, makes you look clever, but it's really bullshit. And before you actually optimize, spend time profiling and analyzing what's going on. Speculative optimization will not, that's not going to make a difference or not going to help you. If it does, it's an accident. String handling. SDRcopy and SDRcat, they can be used safely. They can. But it's actually very hard, and it's an exception. So there are strncopy and strncat, which actually have length checks, but these are really functions for originally, that's where they originate, to handle the UTM file, and not generic C string handling functions. And especially strncat is very hard to use correctly. We found hundreds of examples for buffer overflows in the OpenBSD tree back when we introduced strncopy and strncat that came from incorrect use of strncat. So this is an API, again, that is very easy to abuse or misuse. And as said, it will happen, it has happened, and it still happens. So instead of trying to use them correctly, why not use the safer replacements? In OpenBSD, we have strlcopy and strlcat that are very hard to misuse. And these days, they are available on pretty much every Unix-like operating system. Oh, yeah, there was one exception that I don't think that matters much. How was it called? Linux? So just do what everybody else does. Just get a copy of strlcat, the source file from rlibc, and ship it with your software. If you're doing this correctly and replace all strcopy and strcat invocations with the strl counterparts, means that a year later, when maybe somebody else was working on your program, you can actually grab for potential security issues. So there is a point of using them everywhere. Even if you find a safe invocation of strcat, it's still a good idea to replace it so you're able to grab for potential issues.
Speaking about the UTM stuff, you can also just work around that. For example, we previously very recently switched to UTPX, and that implementation just guarantees that strings are always non-terminated.
Why reinventing the wheel?
Why
are you reinventing the wheel? STRLcat and STRLcopy are around for 10 years or something. They are used everywhere. They are understood.
I'm just saying what it says on the slides that, for UTMP, then you're more likely to use string copy and string cat.
Well, it's not your business to fuck with the UTM file directly.
Yeah, but that's what OpenBSD does.
No.
The only operating system that's in the market that does that.
No. Nobody's fucking with UTM directly.
Yeah. Quite a lot of applications that do that.
Well, maybe read. Oh, it should be fixed. Anyway. I'm not saying our tree is in perfect shape, but it's closer than the other trees, I think. Okay.
Oh, buffer overflows.
Buffer overflows are a notorious problem. I have to pass over the microphones to my colleague.
Kannst du mir helfen?
Doesn't work.
Too many wires.
No, too small pockets. Screw it.
Just a second. Whoa. Can you help me?
As you noticed, we assumed two sets of micro shots.
Yeah, sorry. But now we're going for some examples. Yes, buffer overflow is a very notorious problem. Most security issues or exploits.
Many.
Okay, many. Depend on buffer overflows. They are really simple introduced, especially in C, by making simple programming mistakes. We are coming to that later. OpenBSD has some techniques to make exploiting buffer overflows very much harder. But of course, never depend on them. There may go things wrong anyway.
They are the third line of defense, not your first one.
Yeah. Well, now we are going for a simple example. What happens when a function is called? Okay, we are saving the general registers to stack, calculate the return address in the program, and put it on the stack too. Put the function's arguments on the stack. Local arrays and variables reside on the stack too. The order depends on your environment, but the idea of the stack is generally always the same. Okay, now, simple stack layout.
I keep claiming you can explain any computer problem using beer, so here's the proof.
Yeah, we are proving that. Sorry. The glass is comparable to your memory. So this is a simple stack. Local variables, arrays, the safe stack frame pointer, the return address of the function, and the arguments of the function when it's called. Okay. The program is just filling up the stack. So we are now, first we wrote some local variables, now local arrays. Here we overwrite the stack frame pointer, and okay, after overwriting the return address, we have a buffer overflow. Yeah, was yummy. Okay, now for a simple example. This function is supposed to copy a string into a buffer. And now let's overflow it. We're just handling a string that is a bit too large over to the function, so the return address on the stack is overwritten.
Well, the buffer is overflowed. You don't know whether the return address is actually overwritten, but it could be.
Okay, this would be our aim if we are exploiting this. Well. Okay, now the question, is this really dangerous? Yes. In our simple example, the result is not predictable because we inserted no useful values. We just overflowed. But we wrote to stack sections we weren't supposed to. Perhaps we overwrote the return address. With a well-chosen value, we could determine where the program returns. Okay, we had to look at the stack layout again for this, but it's doable. yeah. And yeah, perhaps we could even insert code. And buffer overflows and stuff doesn't always have to be that obvious. This is a simple,
not so simple
example. obvious. Yeah.
Well, the point is you would expect this program to print one at the end, right?
Yes, and it doesn't, as we are overwriting our buffer again. Okay, I just figured out the values for this exploit or the SAG for an old Linux some years ago. I guess you could easily do it with newer Linuxes again. It's just a bit of work. Okay, to prevent buffer overflows, you always be careful when you're writing to buffers. Length checking is mandatory. Never do any tricks in C that you don't understand. I guess we already had this point.
Not in other languages either.
Use E.
No. This is not language dependent. Just don't do any clever tricks that you don't fully understand, period. Independent of the language.
And string handling is, of course, deals with buffers, so be careful with it too. Don't use strcat and strcopy, use strlcat and strcopy instead, because they are very hard to misuse, and yeah, as always, there's menu page. Oh, format string attacks. Never use user input in format strings. Those you are usually using in stuff like printf and so. You never know what you get from the user. And in this case, we are just printing some parts of the stack just with a simple format string attack. Because the function fprintf will fill in the %s values, and yeah, shouldn't happen. Here, just shortly explained what this s tag does. Printf is called as a function. Functions get the arguments passed on the stack. Each format directive in a format string usually has the corresponding argument passed along. For interpreting format string directives, printf walks up the stack, expecting the right arguments to be there. And if they don't, well, either the attacker gets useful values from your stack, or waste, perhaps. But you get the idea. This can be an attack. This is a correct way of preventing format string attacks. Just handle the strings you're getting from your users as strings. It's that simple. Okay, then some more format string possible format string attacks. You can really have much fun with them. I would say look at them later, try them out. It's fun. Okay, that's okay. Many functions are using format strings. So this is a common security problem too.
It's not a complete list, obviously.
So now I have to hand over to Henning.
I'll try to get the microphones a bit quicker than last time.
Yeah.
Now you have to stand next to me. No, I'm going to take those. Okay. Privileges. You should know and understand what privileges your program needs and for what, right? So a technique that we apply in OpenBSD is what we call principle of least privilege. So everything should run with the least privileges possible. This is another line of defense, right? If things go wrong and the attacker is just an unprivileged user on the system, the impact is different from the attacker having root permissions, right? So you want to use separate users, and it's very important that you do not reuse existing users. If you share the same user between many different programs, the attacker still gains something because something else is running with the same user. And especially using the nobody user is extremely dangerous. It's unfortunately, it was common. It's not as common anymore. Don't do it. Nobody is there for a very specific purpose, which is mapping the root user to another UID for NFS. Actually, the irony being, OpenBSD doesn't use the nobody user for that purpose anymore. But the nobody user is tainted, it's fucked, don't ever use it. Instead, create a new user for your program that must not be used by anything else. In OpenBSD, we just use underscore program name for the usernames, which makes it really clear what they are for, right? Next slide, please.
Yep.
One technique we like and apply is called privilege revocation. Many programs need root privileges, or in general, privileges for a specific operation that only happens on startup. The most common examples are the need to bind to a privileged port, a port below 1024, and to open a file that is not world readable, usually only root and wheel readable. So what if, why don't we just acquire this resource we need, then change root if possible. I'm going to extend the change root part on the next slide. And afterwards, drop the privileges, because at this point, you don't need root permissions anymore. An example in the OpenBSD tree is the DHCPD daemon that needs root privileges to open a BPF file descriptor and to open the lease file. But after having done this, it can drop the privileges, and it does. There are a few more examples. There's spamlogd, there's ping. In that case, the reason for the root privileges it needs is the raw socket. There's TCP dump, there's DHC relay, there's FTP proxy, traceroute, raw socket issue again, traceroute 6, of course, and HTTPD. Change root. It's surprisingly easy to fuck up change root. First, you have to check whether change rooting is possible in your program at all. If you constantly need to open something anywhere in the file system, this doesn't work, of course. If you can change root, you have to decide on where to. A very good candidate that works very often is var empty. Might not exist in other operating systems, not just created. As the name indicates, in OpenBSD, var empty is, well, empty. Actually, that's a lie. There's a logging socket, so you can still syslog, but it's almost empty. Change rooting to the if you use a separate user for your program to drop privileges to, it's a very good idea to change root to the home directory of that user, which is then set to var empty, but this means this can be changed without recompiling the program, which is a plus. It is extremely important to change dir to the new root after change root, and of course, it's very important to actually check the return values. If you don't, you might have failed to change root and well, run unchanged root, which is not exactly what you wanted. Change root by itself is not a security measure. It changes the namespace. It's not a security measure. One reason, root can always escape from the change root. So change rooting without dropping privileges is pretty much useless. And as indicated before, a mostly empty change root gives an attacker, well, if he manages to get to that point, just nothing to play with. So he might have gained control over your program, but there's nothing in the file system that he can use to get any further. Dropping privileges is not as trivial as one thinks it is, because we don't just have user and group IDs. We have the real user and group IDs, we have the effective ones, and we have the saved ones. And then we have the group membership vector. We have to clear or to set them all. The correct form to drop privileges is this one. You set groups, you set res git and set res uid. And again, you're checking the return value because otherwise you might end up still running with the root privileges. In many cases, privilege revocation is not possible because your program constantly needs to do something that requires root privileges. So, how about we split this in a privileged and an unprivileged process? Can I have an unprivileged process, please?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. Unprivileged process. So this unprivileged process running under its separate user, in this case, underscore ntpd, is doing all the work, the protocol handling. If it needs to do something that requires root permissions, it just talks to the privileged process that runs still runs with root permissions. Can I have the root process?
Yeah.
So the root process, dangerous threat. So whenever this is an example from NTPD. Whenever NTPD needs to change the system time, which requires root privileges, this process sends a message to the root process asking it to do so. So whatever goes wrong here, if we have an attacker that took over this process, well, he can't do much. He doesn't have permissions. He's change-rooted. The dangerous stuff is here. He can't send messages to this process, so he could change the system time. Yes, and that is a problem in itself, but we cannot prevent this. But he's not running with root privileges on your system, being able to do anything. So this is a big improvement. The root process, when it gets a message from the unprivileged one to do something privileged, it has to thoroughly check this request. And if anything seems weird with this request, the only safe thing to do is to bail out, terminate the process, and terminate itself. Yeah, well, I kind of showed this already. There are two common reasons why you need to privilege separate instead of just dropping privileges. The probably most common one is you need, as I indicated before, you need root privileges for a certain operation, not just on startup or constantly. The second one is you might have to access something in the file system which you cannot do from within the change root. One of the slightly puzzling but classic examples is DNS, because you have to read resolve.conf and etc host. And if you're using YP or NIST, there's even more stuff that you need to access. Obviously, for privilege separation, the processes need to communicate, so you need messaging between the two. Again, do not reinvent the wheel. Please steal the iMessage framework that I wrote for BGPD many years ago. Today, it's not only BGPD. This is just the list from the OpenBSD tree. It's in BGPD. It's in DVRMPD. This is some multicast thing that I never, ever used. In the NTPD that I mentioned, in our OSPFD, in the routing daemon, the counterpart for IPv shit. It's in RelayD, which is a really nice program to turn an OpenBSD box into a load balancer or SSL offloading engine. Sorry. It's in RIPD, another routing daemon, in our SNMPD, not the shit thing from ports. It's in our SMTPD, which will replace SendMail at one day. It's in TMUX. TMUX is a screen replacement that does not suck. It's in YP LDAP. YP LDAP translates LDAP to YP. And it's in LDPD. This is a daemon dealing with the labels for MPLS. And right now, it's about to become a library. So it will be even easier for you to use this in your own code.
So I've got a question about TMUX. What is there to separate?
To be honest, I just did a find iMessage.c. So in the case of TMUX, I don't know. It's the server daemon site. I think they used the iMessage library for the command line TMUX to communicate with the daemon TMUX. Yes, that's what they do, right. I didn't write TMUX. So a lot of those things were not written by me. So this code is being reused by other developers, which is exactly the purpose. Don't reinvent the wheel. And they, by using this code in other programs, they found bugs that in turn improve the programs where this originated from, right? So sharing code is also a good idea to have other people find issues or deficiencies in your own code. Okay, for privilege separation, there are many, many, many examples in the OpenBSD tree. I have the list here. The interesting ones being SSHD, which was the first program to impose this technique in OpenBSD. And one I really like is MOBD. MOB is the netboot protocol for VAX and I think HB300. It's pretty damn simple, and changing this to be privilege separated took me about an hour. The diff was, I don't remember, maybe 100 lines or so, but it was really small. Outside the OpenBSD tree, leaving pet projects from OpenBSD developers aside, there are exactly two examples we know of. Well, it's QMail and PostFix, and we would very much like that number to be increased, so this is up to you. And to learn how privilege separation works and should be done, The best example, I might be biased here because I wrote it, is NTPD. It is pretty simple, and I'm biased. Well done. This is how NTPD works. NTPD is also a very good example because it has both reasons to privilege separate in the same program. So the root process, all it does is the system calls edge time to slightly change the system clock. After it figured out the systematic error of the clock, it does edge freak to adjust the frequency. And on startup, it might use set time of day to set the clock hard. This requires root. So whenever this is required, the unprivileged process sends a message to the root process asking it to do something. The other process drops privileges but does not change root. And this all it does is DNS requests. The reason why this is a separate process in NTPD, there's another reason, which is not security. The entire thing, of course, is extremely timing critical. And the DNS routines can block. And the engine is never, ever allowed to block. So this was the reason the DNS handling had to be moved to a separate process. Now it's Sven's turn again.
I just do it so we are finished in a few minutes. So, yeah, some... Okay, yeah, some people say that Java is by definition secure because it's running in a virtual machine and stuff.
Just use Google.
And the classical, typical programming errors such as integer overflows and stuff still are in Java. So... As Henning already said, always try to get the best design, always work good. Security is very independent from languages, environments, and the face of the moon. It's mostly a question of good work.
Well,
questions.
On its own? Oh, that's hard. No, not yet. That's hard. You probably have to buy some beer to overflow it yourself. Yeah. Well, I think you were first. Because it's overloaded. Many different programs used the nobody user when they wanted to drop privileges. So now you have 10, 15 daemons running on your system that use the nobody user to be independent from everything else. But now when somebody gains, exploits one of those and is running as nobody user, there suddenly is a lot of stuff in the system that is accessible for nobody. And this is dangerous. Because, well, the idea was that it's independent, right? I think it's bullshit. That's too complicated. Nobody's ever going to get this right. This is simple, and if you follow the few simple guidelines, it's going to work.
It's not simple because you spawn extra process and do a lot of
work. It is simple. You just go to NTPD and copy the code.
Change root doesn't. Things like change root are just false security. You know, you can still access the network stack, for example. You know, when you've got.
No. You got this very wrong. Change root is not false security. Change root by itself is not a security measure. I said that. Change root is just one little building block to write secure programs. Because if an attacker gains control, it's also the second line of defense. If an attacker gains control over your program, he has nothing to play with. And this is the point. Your security features, I think security features are bullshit. There are no security features.
Well,
The key for security is software quality, and you're not getting software quality by using some piece of shit software and adding something on top or around it.
Well,
so
you just said the principle of least privilege is important. Now, how do
yes,
you
it is.
The principle of least privilege if there are no OS foundations for it?
We have the foundation. It's called a separate user. All the other schemes are so complicated that they are never, ever going to be right. Just look at Windows and their how is it called, the capabilities, whatever bullshit. Pardon?
Universal access control.
But how is that
never, ever going to be right.
Accessing the network stack, for example.
What do you mean by accessing the network stack?
Well, you can create sockets and...
That's true.
Yeah.
So?
So that's a privilege that a lot of people...
It kind of is, yes.
Okay.
So, you're making... See, you will not be able to have a second line of defense that prevents all kinds of issues. To prevent your attacker from calling home, well, maybe it would be a good idea to do something about this. We didn't really think about that yet, because we have a solution that's called PF. Like, you have a firewall that controls your network traffic. So there is your network access limiter. But I agree there could be more. It hasn't, well, maybe we should do it. I don't know.
Be sure to look at Capsicum.
Maybe.
Rob Watson is going to give a talk about that, maybe, or not.
If he does, I'll certainly go look at it. No more questions?
You mentioned using printfs and signal handlers. I was under the assumption that you don't want to allocate memory in signal handlers.
That's one reason, but also you must not use anything in a signal handler that modifies the internal state of the standard I/O stack. Like, you might enter your signal handler in the middle of another printf from your main program. Not good. Again, books that I recommend?
Any books?
Books.
Book by Robert Secord is good.
Yeah.
It's by far the best book.
I have to admit that I can't really. I'm not the computer book person. They don't work for me. But, well, everybody's different.
Would the StyleMan page have anything on?
The StyleMan page?
The OpenBSD StyleMan page have anything?
The StyleMan page really just tells you how code should look like. It's a style. Well, as the name indicates, it's a style guideline. It's ours. Yours might be different. The point is that this is about programming in a team, obviously. The point is code that looks alike is easy to follow for another developer. No more questions? We're out of time anyway, but maybe 2 minutes. Then, famous last request. Nobody ever fulfills it, so this time we just did it ourselves. Cheers. Cheers.
We only have two, sorry.
Canadian border.
Yeah.